You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Great afternoon, Greenbelts. Everyone dry-ish? No, exactly, yes. I got very wet last night, so there we go. Great, so welcome to this session. We're going to have a bit of a conversation together around this issue of youth violence, which feels, I don't know how you feel about it, but to me, I've been involved in youth work for kind of 30 years, and it feels like a really growing and almost intractable like issue in our country. And potentially it used to be something that we just thought about was relevant to maybe like the inner cities or areas of kind of high deprivation, but actually it feels like lots more communities are being affected by youth violence. We've both experienced where young people that we've known have lost their lives to it. I mean, I've certainly experienced young people who've gone to prison, do you know what I mean, for committing where they've cost the life of another young person. So it's a really kind of important issue, I think, for us to kind of explore together. So we're going to have a bit of a conversation like together about that for kind of 30 to 40 minutes, and then we'll open it up for a few questions and exploration together. Does that sound all right? Everyone all right with that? Yep. Excellent. Brilliant. So let's start maybe with Governor B, maybe you're saying a little bit about yourself and a little bit about kind of why this whole issue of violence amongst young people is such an important thing like to you. Do you want to kick us off?
Sure. Thank you. Hello, everyone. Don't you think that as well as being good for the environment, it makes you feel like you're opening a can of beer, which is quite a nice thing. Dual purpose. My name's Isaac. That's the name my mum gave me. So feel free to refer to me as Isaac for the rest of this conversation. I grew up in East London, a place called Custom House. My parents are from Ghana. They came over to England in their early 20s, had me and my younger brother. Both my parents are Christians. And African, which basically meant I went to church from as soon as I came out of my mum's womb. And I had a good upbringing. We was raised on a council estate. The thing I loved about the estate was the breadth of different people that were there. We had first generation Africans, Caribbeans, working class, British people, people from South America, all over Europe. And it's almost as if our differences made us all the same, if you know what I mean. In a way, the church youth group was also pretty good for me. Had loads of good influences there, but I was quite insecure as a young person. My parents worked a lot, so they weren't at home much, and I was kind of left to my own devices a little bit. And for some reason, I don't know why it was attractive, but I would look outside my bedroom window and I'd see some of the kind of gangs on the estate or the people that were getting up to you're more like antisocial behavior. And I would see the result of some of the activity, and it was really attractive to me. So I'd see like the money, the latest trainers, the cars, the girls, you know what I mean? And I thought to myself, that lifestyle seems quite appealing. But deep down, I was actually not really built for that life. I was a bit of, I wasn't that kind of guy. I wasn't like a brave individual. I was like risk averse as a child, but I wanted to be around it. So I started hanging around on the estate a little bit. And whenever I was on the estate or whenever I'd go to school, I'd always end up getting into trouble. Just for trying to be a bit of a class clown, didn't do anything too serious. But it didn't make sense to my parents or my youth leader at church, because when I was at home or I was at church, I was a pretty good kid. But yeah, away from that, always loved music. Anyone love music here? Yeah. So in East London at the time that I was growing up, there was a bit of, I'd say, a grime music movement of a lot of prominent artists, Dizzy Rascal, Kano, Wiley, those kind of people. And I started writing my own music. And I thought, you know what, I'm like a teenager, doesn't really know what to write about. So I just talk about what everyone else is talking about, which is basically girls, drugs, guns. I didn't have a gun, didn't do any drugs, didn't get any girls, but I thought, let me do it anyway.
You're describing my teenage years as well, so you're all right.
And it actually went okay, but at the age of, I'd say 15,
one of my good friends on the estate, Bienda, was murdered and lost his life. And I just thought about some of the lyrics that I was writing, and it just felt weird to glorify that kind of behavior when I came face to face with the people that it had affected in a really bad way. So his family, his friends, myself included. And that was probably like a massive turning point in my life and in the music that I created. And the interesting thing about that situation is that he was murdered by a pair of brothers that we also knew on the estate. And these were guys that I grew up with. Their mum knew my mum. We was all kind of like one big family in a way. And I never really viewed the brothers as like bad guys. They were just kids on the estate, just like all of us. But for whatever reason, one thing led to another, and they've ended up murdering one of our other friends. And I don't think I really processed it at the time, because I don't think I had the tools to. But the subject matter of my music changed into more positive themes, because I wanted to see change in my community. And that's kind of like my introduction to life and youth violence, I guess.
Great. Brilliant. Thanks, Isaac. And right, really difficult like circumstances, isn't it, to think about. I wonder if like you've managed to do any kind of further reflecting on what was the context of those young people's lives that kind of got them into that. What are the kind of what you might describe as the kind of driving factors, if you like, for that? It's a complex thing, right? So we often get into simple answers, don't we, to these things? It's all the fault of poor parenting or the attraction of drugs or these kind of things. And it's obviously a bit more complex than that. But what would you say are the kind of things that you think are driving some of this violence that you've seen and experienced and that perhaps lots of communities are?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like you say, it's very complicated. I'm not going to talk about fault, but I'll talk about what I've noticed on reflection. The first thing is we were living in poverty, essentially.
Okay.
It wasn't extreme poverty like we maybe see on TV adverts and that kind of stuff. And I don't think I realized it at the time, because my parents did what they could to ensure that I wasn't affected. But it's only when I look back in hindsight and I realize, my parents were never really at home. They had a couple of jobs at a time. There was times I remember where I was having dinner, but they weren't. And you start to think, okay, it was a real struggle for them. And that would have been the story of quite a few people on my estate. The other thing I would say is it's more like kind of emotional intelligence and understanding how to process and communicate your feelings. Those weren't necessarily tools that I learned as a kid. And so when things happened on my estate that I guess kids that did have those skills would maybe talk about it around a dinner table or have the people in their families and their friendship groups to be able to process this stuff with, we didn't necessarily have that. Even when Bienda passed away, I remember all of us were upset, but we did the kind of like hyper-masculine thing of not crying. And the next day, it's almost as if life went on and we kind of swept it under the carpet and buried it. So I'd say things like not having access to the services and the individuals that can help us process our trauma is a massive thing. And another thing I'll talk about is maybe a lack of aspiration. I'd always watch like these TV shows. Like, anyone watch The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air growing up? Yeah. It was a big house they lived in, innit? But I just never ever thought, it's a stupid example, but I just never ever thought that could be me. I never saw past my estate. I just thought that this was life. I didn't really look to the future, and I don't think any of us did. It was just another day on the estate. We didn't really talk about what we wanted to be when we're older, aside from, I don't know, at the time it was probably maybe Cristiano Ronaldo or like a footballer or like whoever the biggest rapper was at the time or musician. We didn't say, I really want to be like an accountant, or I really want to be a doctor, or I really want to work in the creative arts. We were so short-sighted. I actually remember now thinking about it, there was a guy, he must have been on work experience that we all knew, and he got work experience at like one of the big banks. I don't know whether it was like JP Morgan, something like that, like whatever. And he wore like a suit and shoes. And we was just like, we was laughing at him. Like, we were laughing at him.
Yeah.
But I look back at that now and think, actually, Like, he had his head screwed on. He should have been celebrated. But our definition of success was so warped. So yeah, like you say, there's a variety of issues. I can't put my finger on one, but poverty, a lack of aspiration, and a lack of services that can aid us in communicating, processing, and our mental health.
Yeah. Let's see if this resonates. One of the things that we did in the youth work that we were doing is, I remember having a conversation with a young person, and he said, basically, there's a bit of a deal that goes on, right? You get to about 13, and you kind of understand that society has created a bit of a deal for you. Like, if you kind of do the right things, this is what the outcome will be. And he said, when that gets broken or you can't see it, like, you have to find meaningfulness in something else.
Yeah.
Whether that's like the local gang, like making money in a different way, like, et cetera. And he talked about this idea of a poverty of hope. Like, if young people don't grow up feeling that they can live hopeful lives, actually the deal gets broken. Mm. And then actually you get to that kind of difficult period of teenage life, and actually you're really, like, influenced by other things and tempted by other things, because actually you can't see the route to a productive life. Like, how much does that resonate, do you think? How much this, because Christians talk all the time about hope, and we talk about it sometimes in very abstract kind of terms. How much important do you think that is, that a young person can see, like, a hopeful future for themselves?
Oh, I think it's massively important. One of my favorite quotes, I don't know who said it, so you can attribute it to me if you want to.
You heard it first.
But if you can't see yourself, it's hard to be yourself. And I love that, because I think vision is so important. And for a young person growing up in a community that I grew up, I think there's different access points or different reasons why you might get involved with people that are involved with youth violence. So for me, it was always, I wanted community, because my house felt quite empty. It's just me, my younger brother. Our age gap was 6 years. My parents worked a lot. I just wanted friends. And before I became embedded in my church youth group, I had nowhere else to really feel like I belonged. And my estate could provide that for me, even though they were getting up to things that I had no interest in. For another person, it might be that, you know, my parents thankfully didn't pass on their struggles to me. But another person might, their parent might not literally be able to afford rent, so they want to go out and by any means earn whatever money that they can earn, and that's their entry point, you know. So yeah, I think if you don't have a vision for what your future can be, you're just going to take whatever's put in front of your face that looks appealing and attractive, whether that's for belonging purposes or whether that's because you think it's the best way that you can earn money.
So creating spaces for belonging, identity, a sense of yourself, a sense of friendship, like, that's a good starting point for then thinking about
For sure,
what your life could look like. A church youth group, for example, gets you in a different space than perhaps some of your friends were in.
Yeah, because that was the turning point for me when I felt like I belonged because of my church youth group. I didn't really need to get involved in anything else, and they were doing positive things for me. So I think we read a lot about the lack of, or the cuts in youth services, and the fact that youth groups aren't what they used to be. And I think that's true. But I do think if they came back, they maybe play a slightly different role now. Like, back then, table tennis was like enough. Do you know what I mean?
Are you saying it's not enough now? Like,
I just think we live in a different world. So you can still have the table tennis, but also, maybe if you had someone that was already involved in the world of finance that could provide like a connecting point to, oh, have you thought about doing this in the future? Or someone that worked in sport, or someone that worked in the arts. Whereas back then life was a lot simpler. But now I actually think we're growing up a lot quicker. Like, a lot of my youth work used to be mainly in secondary schools. Now I'm getting asked more and more to come into primary schools, because by the time you get to year seven, some deem it too late to be able to change a young person's mind. It's almost like that prevention is better than cure thing, you know?
And you talked earlier about this idea of you guys didn't quite have the tools, was the term that you used, to kind of process stuff, to navigate the world, like, et cetera. What are these kind of tools that, as a society, really, we should be enabling these young people, like, to develop? And why on earth are we not, when we spend so much money on things like education, why are we not giving young people these tools that help them navigate the world well?
That's a good question. I think for me, I didn't really realize that I was lacking in many areas until my dad passed away in 2017, and I just tried to carry on like I always have. in life, but it was very hard to. And a few months later, while I was in America, I remember just like breaking down in tears on the beach. I don't know why I went to the beach, because I can't actually swim or anything like that, but it's apparently what you do. And up until that point, I always thought, like, as a guy, if you cry, you're like a weak man. But after I had like cried, I actually felt like relief. I felt lighter, and that kind of started me on the journey of like therapy and trying to figure out how to process some of this stuff. And I was in a bit of a privileged position because I could afford to, you know, pay, I think it was £50 a session at the time for like a therapist. And it made me realize that actually, if you want access to that kind of help, for example, as a young person where I'm coming from, there's a few barriers that would stop you. Number one is probably trust. Like, you've lived your whole life doing stuff that maybe you shouldn't, not being able to trust people, being hurt, being let down by your primary relationships, sitting down with a random person in a room and telling them what you're struggling with is probably going to feel quite uncomfortable. The second barrier is just because of the lack of funding and the state that the NHS is in, you're going to be on a waiting list for a long time. People that don't really understand the effects of youth violence won't view you as a priority. And it's just like, there's no immediacy of help, and the funds are maybe not distributed in a way that puts people from those backgrounds at the top of the list. Yeah. So it's tough.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? Like, I think like one of the things I've talked a bit about is if you've got a whole bunch of young people in a particular like community or area or neighborhood wandering around kind of carrying anxiousness, anxiety, poor mental health, a level of trauma, like, etc. Like, there's the science behind this, right? Isn't there? Like, about, there might be people in the audience who know this better than me, but to do with like cortisol levels, etc. So there's a biological element like to it. People know about cortisol levels and all that kind of stuff, right? That actually, when you're a, the example I always use actually is when you're a baby and you need help, like you cry, right? Don't you? That's what babies do. People who've like been parents and stuff, isn't it? Like, anxiety kind of rises in a baby. And then what happens is their primary caregiver comes and comforts them, like, and then deals with the issue, like whether it's, I mean, a dirty nappy, needing food, like, etc. If you spend your early years not having those needs met or not having them met well, or even experiencing a level of abuse or violence in it, like, actually you don't learn to regulate. You don't learn, to kind of manage that well. And then what happens is, as you get into your teenage years, you're wandering around with this cortisol level at a high level. You're wandering around with anxiousness and stuff. So you're already kind of on edge the whole time. If you then put a weapon in that young person's hands, a young person has a weapon in their hands and they're wandering around with this anxiousness, do you see what I mean? Like, there's no one. There's some science behind this stuff, isn't it? It's not just psychology. There's actually a biological element to this stuff.
It comes from pain and the need to try and escape the pain. And if you're in pain, most people will ask for help. Like you say, if that help is not there, you're going to try and escape it. And if you can't escape it, you're going to become numb to it.
Yeah.
And when you become numb to it, you're not in a good space. And I always say, like, a 4-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, they don't want to be a violent person. They don't want to become embroiled in antisocial behavior. But a 10, 11, a 12-year-old might.
Yeah.
What happens in that gap? And in that gap is probably a disconnect, a letting down by your primary caregiver or the primary people in your life or your primary influences. And I think that if we can try and figure out what happens in that gap, that's where we start to get some answers that can create sustainable change rather than trying to do it too far ahead.
So if I made you prime minister for the day...
Don't do that.
Anyone else like to be prime minister for the day? Like, we could do it as a green belt thing. If I made you prime minister for the day, like, to focus on that, like, what... To put you on the spot, like, what would you do? Like, what would be some key policy things that you think would be really important to kind of navigate that space that you've just talked about?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I would probably do, and that's helped me learn most in this area, is collaboration. We spoke a little bit about this earlier, but the Prime Minister doesn't know everything about every kind of social struggle that we have at the moment. So what do you do from that point? You bring in people that are proximate, that are working at grassroots level to inform you, because they have the lived experience, the knowledge, experience of working with people at that level that can really help make change. But I think what happens is at like policy level, they hold the keys, right? And they might bring people in for collaboration on like a surface level. But when it comes to the point of actually trusting them and handing over those keys because they're doing the work, that doesn't happen because they have to maintain the power and the control. But I think, and this isn't just me like as a Christian speaking, but if I wanted to see change as like a prime minister, at the point where I'm working with people that really know their stuff and that are at grassroots level, I'm working with young people day in, day out, I would relinquish power because you know more than I do in this area. And that takes like a lot of humility, I guess. It takes trust. But I think if we keep the keys to ourselves in positions of influence and power, we're only scratching the surface with the work that we can do.
Yeah.
I really hope I didn't answer that like a prime minister would answer that. And that I did well. I don't know.
Well, you got a round of applause. Oh, so thanks. You're on the money, my friend. That's yeah, really good, isn't it? Like, so, you know, Greenbelt as activists, people who want to make change in the world. And you've just articulated actually the importance of stuff at the grassroots, stuff at the ground level. Lots of people will be, you know, doing all kinds of professional jobs. People will be in churches that are in communities. Like if you were to kind of help Greenbelters think about what actually they can do when you've just articulated how important kind of grassroots work is, like what is it that Greenbelters can do to play their part in actually bringing about some level of change for our young people?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. There's a few things really. I'd say proximity, which I've mentioned already, is really important. I think that these kind of issues look very, very different the closer you get to them. So if there's any opportunities to volunteer with organizations at the grassroots, just to learn more, to help yourself become more empathetic, because I forgot what you call it actually. There's, you probably know the term for it or someone here, but you can get fatigued with all the different issues.
Compassion fatigue, yeah.
Compassion fatigue. I knew you'd know it. You can get
my
compassion
one useful
fatigue.
Contribution to this conversation.
Nah, you're very useful, very useful. But you can get compassion fatigue. There's so many different, to open the Greenbelt program, there's seminars on a few different issues. But I think if you're proximate, it's really hard not to feel empathy. It's really hard not to want to do something. So I'd say volunteer if you can. I'm an ambassador for a great charity called Power the Fight that empower communities to end youth violence. It's always a good starting point. They've got loads of videos that can kind of help educate you and connect you with people in your local communities that are doing some good work. The other thing I'd say is the importance of community, which we've mentioned as well. I think the world that we live in are very quick to say that this issue is here because the parents aren't doing a good enough job. Everyone's passing the buck. The parents might say, yeah, but look at the health service. The health service might say, yeah, but look at policy. But I think as Christians, our approach is probably quite different. I think it says in Corinthians that like we're all part of the body and everyone plays their part. And I like to think that that's God's attitude to just mankind in general. So like that old African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child. And I know that life's different. I grew up in a time, I'm not that old, but I grew up in a time where like my next door neighbor could tell me off just as much as my parents could. These days, we don't even know what our next door neighbor's name is. Do you know what I mean? So in any way that we can build community and look out for people, I think that makes a huge difference. And then the other thing I'd say is like immediacy. Some of us might be in a position where, yeah, if a young person needs counseling, they are on the list for 6 months. But maybe there's a way that we can work with charitable organizations to speed up that process, whether it's via donations or whatever. But I'd say, yeah, proximity, community and immediacy. And also everyone can play their part. Like no one can solve this issue by themselves, but no contribution is too small. And I think if everyone does a little bit, it makes a huge difference.
Amazing. Like, brilliant. Brilliant. Hopefully that's inspired us to think about like what action that we can take. Yeah, brilliant. Anybody who knows me will know that actually community building is one of the things I'm most
passionate about. You're actually, he's being quite humble here, so you might not know everything that he does, but why don't you tell us a little bit about your background in youth work and how long you've been doing this for?
Okay, well, very briefly. So actually, this, I'll link it to the story about community, actually, like, if that's all right. So, like, I first started doing youth work in, like, my first youth work job was 1993. So this is where Greenbelt goes, you don't look old enough, right? So I was working with young people who were involved in the criminal justice system, young people who were unemployed, young people who came from so-called disadvantaged kind of communities. And we used kind of outdoor education stuff like canoeing, climbing, drumming, etc., to kind of take them out of a bit of their comfort zone, actually, but also to help you put young people learn lots of those skills that they don't get, like, in school. And then I've been involved in, like, community-based youth work, like, for a long, long time. And now, like, one of the journeys for me was the question you asked, actually, which was, I live on a estate in the east part of Birmingham, like, in inverted commas, in the indices of deprivation, one of the poorest communities in the country. And we were doing youth work there. And here's the question I asked, actually, because you raised the village question. I asked the question, what does it mean for this community to raise its children well? Like, how do we do that? It can't be just reliant on whether there's a really good youth worker or a youth work organisation there. That can't be the answer. In fact, actually, are we a bit of a sticking plaster to, like, a whole societal, like, problem? Like, how do we do that? We sort of default to, well, if only the council would do this, or if only we had this service, or if we only did these things. But my take was, actually, we are all responsible. They are our kids. Like, we are all responsible for raising our kids, not just the parents, but the village. So if it takes a village to raise a child, who's paying attention to the village? Who's helping build the village in which people can live flourishing lives, including young people? So that got me into this thing called asset-based community development, which is a thing that I'd spend a lot of my time kind of helping people think about, which is, how do we strengthen communities from the strengths that people already have? And how do we help communities actually go, do you know what? We are going to nurture our kids. We're going to care for our vulnerable. We're going to look after our green spaces. Do you know what I mean? Like, we are going to build community life together, not to let the council, the NHS or others kind of off the hook, but let them do the things they're meant to do. Yeah. But community, as citizens, we are citizens, we have a responsibility to each other. Body of Christ stuff, right? But that's not just the church, that's society, I think. And so one of my journeys was to kind of try and do community building as well as youth work, to try and help think about what it looks like for young people to grow up well. And I think that's a good question to ask. What does it take for young people to grow up well? And how have we created this society where young people feel that for some young people, the only avenues are these avenues that you've been describing? Like, how have we got there? And actually, it's really easy to just come up with kind of specific interventions or blaming certain people. But actually, we're all responsible for getting our society to that point. Like, and so what is it that we can do to help create a society in which young people feel, children and young people feel, they can grow up well, not just in their family, but in their neighborhood? What does that look like?
Yeah, so that's really thought. Good. That's that'd amazing. And
you didn't have to clap. It's all right.
Nah, it's good stuff. And the kind of more and more as I'm having conversations, one thing a lot of people have learned is we can't sit back and just trust policymakers to do what they're supposed to do. So, what is our response? Do we just say, "Oh well," or do we activate? And I think a good way to think about it is, this feels like a macro issue, but just think about it in really small terms. So just look at the block that you live in, or the road that you live in, and think of, what difference can I make on this road? Yeah. And then branch out from there. Okay, what difference can I make in my borough, and then city, and then it starts to flow out?
I really like, just to give away my politics a bit, like, I've just watched the speeches from the Obamas at the Democratic Convention, right? But do you remember the speech that Barack Obama gave back in the day when he talked about where he got the kind of fired up, ready to go, like, mantra? Have you heard that story? Like, so he went to this kind of really small gathering of about 20 people, and he heard this lady who kept repeating this mantra, fired up, ready to go. Like, and people kept repeating it to her. His take on it was, that actually her fired up, ready to go, changed the room. It changed the dynamics of the room. And his mantra was, if one voice can change a room, it can change a neighborhood. It can change a state, because remember, this is the United States. It can change a country. It can change the world. And I really, really liked that idea that one voice can change the way that we talk about stuff. Do you know what I mean? There's a different, do you know what I mean, kind of like dynamic, if you like, kind of like to it. So, sorry, my... just to apologise, my kids have just waved like really vigorously at me at the back going, what on earth is my dad doing up on the stage? So I do apologise. Like, well, here they come, like, you know, round of applause for my kids. I've lost track of my thought process, like, now. Let's, I tell you what, should we open it up? Should we hear, like, that's enough of us kind of having a bit of a conversation. Hopefully that stimulated a few thoughts, a few perspectives. You might have some expertise as well to kind of share. We'd love to hear your questions, your comments, like, et cetera. And we've got a few minutes to do that. We've got a bit of a roving mic. So if we could do that, there's someone there. There's a couple of people at the back there.
So, because you bigged up your kids, I've got to big up my niece just in the front. Make some noise.
Yeah, round of applause for niece. Zadie. Great. Do you want to go here first? These guys at the front. And we'll work our way back.
Hello, you're of different generations. I'm wondering if you have anything to say about the creation and demise of Sure Start Centres for Early Invention and how that screwed things up when the last government removed that.
Do you want to talk? Want me to talk? Yes, I tell you what's really interesting, actually, is that the person who designed Sure Start Centres in the last Labour government was Yvette Cooper, who is now the Home Secretary. And she, if you look at the Labour government's policy, it's around establishing youth hubs to try and tackle that stuff. So she's taken the mantra. The point about Sure Start is there is a ton of research and evidence about how you impact children when they're very young and the difference that it makes. So, you know, the mantra I was saying about you've got teenagers wandering around like with all that stuff, and it's because actually they've inherited that from when they were young, which is a bit like what you were talking about, right? So I think actually going back to that kind of early years and doing it well, that's some of the tools I think that you're talking about, because actually that happens from when we're tiny. So is that right? Someone else? Yep.
Hi. Oh, gosh. This question for both of you. So across the years, a lot of people have felt called by God to go and work and live in the States and have had their hearts broken for the young people who live there. And when they go, they often face many cultural barriers, whether that's socioeconomic or religious or political or whatever barrier that might be there. And it's a massive culture shock. What would you want them to know going into that space?
I think people that want to do that are some of the most well-meaning people that you'll come across and feel deeply challenged to make a difference in the area. But my kind of advice would be training is really important because the landscape of young people has changed quite a bit. And I guess I'd describe it as like being culturally competent is not an easy thing. You need to learn how to do that. So an example is Hackney, which is a borough that I lived quite close to. 15, 20 years ago, it's probably quite easy to like open up a youth centre there, for example. But now it would actually be quite different because there are estates within Hackney that are literally a few metres from each other that are at war with each other. And if you're not culturally competent, you'll be well-meaning and think, oh, I'm just going to do this here, and you'll cause a whole heap of drama and palaver. So I think that training youth leaders, people that want to go into the estates about the kind of cultural barriers that they can face, whether that's from like a religious point of view, whether that's just from a postcode wars point of view, is really important. So not skipping that step would be my advice. In terms of who facilitates that, there are a few organisations that are doing quite good work, but I'd say it's not as simple as just kind of rocking up with your suitcases and as well intentioned as you may be.
Yeah, probably just a couple of things to add that, because actually, so one of the missiological things that I can't remember who the author is actually talks about is this idea of there's kind of three groups of people, kind of remainers, returners and relocators. like, so Remainers are people who've grown up in the community. Returners are people who maybe go off to university and come back again. Relocators are people like, well, I did 20 years ago, like in my estate. So I'm one of those relocating people. I think you have to relocate with humility. I think you have to relocate not with a messianic kind of complex, like that you're here to fix and rescue the poor. I think this is why I'm such a proponent of asset-based community development, because asset-based community development starts with what's strong and not what's wrong. And so actually you go and look for signs of the kingdom of God actually in the community that you're in. If you're into missiology, missio deo is the idea that God is already present. The kingdom is already present. Our job is to go and join in with whatever God is up to, like in a place. So that kind of like how you show up, like I think is really like important. You're not there to rescue the place. Do you know what I mean? You're there to offer in humility, like your own gifts and skills kind of into that context and seeing the strengths and possibilities, do you know what I mean, that exist there. So that'd be like a couple of thoughts about thinking about how you show up. I've seen people get burnt out with the heroic kind of idea.
Yeah.
And they buy into that because their well-meaning friends who haven't done that will say to them, oh, you're a hero for doing that. Do you know what I mean? And it's not actually. Do you know what I think? If we're going to use hero language, it's people who've got through the shit of life and are still standing. Like, and actually, those are the people that are the heroes of those stories, I think. Cool. Yeah. Do you have another question?
Over here, and then I'm going to go to the back. Hi there. I'm a teacher in a very deprived school in Stoke-on-Trent, and I've been teaching children who grew up as in the life of crime. If you want to say that. Obviously, gang culture is very rife in Stoke-on-Trent. And I agree with you to work on the youth, but how can we work on the families, not to break them up? But obviously, children are now in the third generation of growing up in this environment. How can we break up the culture of grandparents have never known anything different, parents have never known any different? And young children, as young as reception children, see this as a normal now. Is there any way we can work on the generation so that families bond rather than be broken up?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think first thing to say is that it's partly your responsibility, but it's not all your responsibility. So hopefully you don't feel that pressure too much. But when I think about the best relationships that I had with my teachers and the teachers that my family respected in terms of my mum and my dad, they were almost like teachers that built friendships with me and my parents. It's almost as if people don't care what you know until they know that you care. And when my mum realized that my English teacher or my head teacher, Miss Arnonson, really cared about my well-being and my future, she kind of relaxed a little bit and started to work with her rather than against her. And I know that we almost live in a world where teachers have to be so careful with their relationships. But I'd say if you can get to a point where you're trying to show that you are empathetic and you're not just doing a job and you're wanting to build friendships, I think that earns trust. And maybe even some of those more difficult parents and grandparents that have been in this cycle for so long start to let their guards down and work with you.
Just a couple of things to add to that. Actually, like a really good on relationship to teachers and stuff is, anyone seen the Ian Wright video? Ian Wright, the ex-footballer?
Yeah.
Like, about his teacher and the difference that his teacher made. And here's what Ian Wright said. He said that, I can't remember the teacher's name. It's a very moving video, by the way, like if you watch it. He said the difference that teacher made was, he said, that teacher saw me. That teacher saw me. Like I wasn't just one of 30 in a class. He saw me and he saw something in me. And he talks about actually being made the milk monitor when he was one of the naughtiest kids in the class. And the point I would use about that is to go back to my little mantra of use what's strong, not what's wrong. That teacher saw the goodness in Ian Wright and the possibility in Ian Wright and gave him responsibility. When what we normally do is we say naughty kids and naughty people and people who are deficit people, like what we do is punish them. Like what if we started to see the strengths kind of in the possibility? So that I'm doing some work with, I won't name the trust, but an academy, big academy trust around there. They've developed community hubs in their schools. And the reason is because they were going, it doesn't work putting on parenting classes for parents, because all you're doing is telling parents who already feel a bit rubbish about themselves that they're crap parents. Like, who wants to go to a parenting class where you're being made to feel that you're crap? Would any of you go to something where you were being... Actually, if you do this strength-based kind of approach, you can kind of begin to build people's confidence in themselves and the sense of friendship and connection and relationship and belonging. And actually, what that School Academy Trust has pulled off is they're making parents feel part of the school community now. But not because they're wagging their finger at them, telling them they're rubbish parents, but because they're actually inviting them into community life together. And that is engaging parents. And they've literally seen the data around things like attendance get much better because parents are beginning to kind of really engage with the school, but starting with what's strong and not what's wrong. So I think community development and youth work and education, like, these things need to go together. Like, I think one of the other things that goes on in our policy making is we silo everything. Those people, those of you who may be involved in some of this stuff, you know, you maybe get some funding to work on issues around mental health, or you get funding to run issues around employment, like, etc. But actually, people are whole people, and actually, we don't work with people as whole people very often. We kind of work with them because they've got a particular deficit, a particular problem that we are trying to fix. And I just think that's the wrong way to do things. So sorry to go back to my little mantra about asset-based approaches, but that's why I'm such an evangelist for asset-based approaches, because it enables people to feel good about themselves, to feel they've got strengths and skills and gifts and possibilities. And our young people need to know that. Like, they need to know that, that they've got, you know, you discovered music as a real gift. Like, but every either we believe God has gifted everybody or we don't. So if God has... If we believe that God has gifted everybody, let's help them discover their gifting. And when you discover your gifting and you live out of your gifting, life is so much more enjoyable, passionate, engaging, like, etc. So let's do that with parents. Let's do that with communities. Let's do that with kids. Let's help people discover what they're passionate about, what they're good at, and let's help them do it. And then maybe the world will be a bit better.
Does someone have their hand up over there? Or not? I think it was the lady behind you, then you can go.
You need to be where the mic is.
Oh, sorry.
Needs to be where the mic is.
I get like that sometimes, start taking
I'm not over. Keeping an eye on the time, by the way, so I'm hoping you're going to keep an eye on it. Okay, that's right then. Youth workers never put us in charge of time.
Hi, Governor. Question for you on the whole issue of growing up and the role models and the aspirations and the link to parents, especially those of us like you and me who had West African parents who had those standard jobs we had to have, doctor, lawyer, engineer, I think was the third one. Do you think that within all not seeing those, just the fact that our parents had that helped us, and does that still exist today? Are African parents or parents generally still insisting, you must do this, you must do that? Or is that going...
I think it's still there. I'm an African parent, and with my kids...
this is confession time that's coming.
No, I'm a bit more flexible, but I think the crux of what you're saying is, as a parent and as a community, do we provide our young people with enough opportunities to want to excel and aspire to be something great? I think historically... From my West African background, it's always been very limited, as you say, you know, doctor. I remember the first time I told my mum I wanted to be a rapper properly. That wasn't a good day, man. But it worked out in the end.
That's the only reason I didn't become a rapper, because I didn't dare tell my mum.
But I'd say what should still exist, and hopefully does, is we want you to be the best that you can be. And we want to provide you with the platform to reach your full potential. In many ways, the end result isn't actually important. You know, whatever you want to do that can provide you with a livelihood, we want you to do that. But we're going to provide you with the best opportunity to do that. And I think that does still exist. And I think maybe the options are much more broader now. But the challenge is the access points.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's something I was going to say, actually. Like, so there's lots of, there's been lots of research around, and this won't surprise any of you, right? Is, it's not that, some kids from some communities, just because they happen to come from that community, are brighter than other kids. So what is it they have a huge leap up on is the social networks and connections that often their parents have. So actually, you know, if your dad is a banker, you can go and do work experience in a bank. And it's not only the work experience, it's the connections that you build and that your dad introduces you to people, like, etc. That's how inequality, I think, often works, etc. So we have to work harder in some communities to create these networks for people. I mean, I'm involved in some work in East Birmingham. East Birmingham is a very... I don't like these terms because I'm a strengths-based person, right? But if you let me use it, like a disadvantaged kind of part of the country, never mind Birmingham. And we are trying to do a lot of work to help connect young people to the wider kind of business, sport, culture, arts, infrastructure of the city. Because that those things are not based in East Birmingham. Like, they're based in other parts of the city. So they're a resource for the city, but they don't know how to connect with kids growing up, like where I live.
Yeah.
And actually what we want to do is say, and their parents don't have those connections into those things. So what we're doing is trying to create those connections for those young people, like, to actually help them engage with those things and go, do you know what? Actually, I'd never thought about theatre or music or sport, or I never thought about some of these, like these connections as a possibility for me. And I think one of the things that goes on with parents goes back to your question, is a natural parent's instinct is they want their kids to do better than them, isn't it? That's a natural parental instinct, isn't it? So it comes actually from often a good place, etc. But if we don't create those roots, do you know what I mean, for young people, then some parents try and do that kind of, kind of for them, because actually they can't see the societal way of doing that. And I think we have to create those things for people.
Yeah, I think that's what I meant about Youth Hub is playing a slightly different role to what they did back in the day, in addition to the table tennis, providing access points to those different, you know, job opportunities and ways of progressing.
And it might be for some of you that actually you think, actually, I'd never thought about where I work. Actually, I'd never thought about trying to influence the company I work for, etc., being a place that actually could do that. But actually, maybe I could. Maybe I could go back and say, actually, this is something we could do. And there's really good examples, isn't there? Timpsons is a really good example of a great company. Iceland are going into prisons, like, and doing interviews of people, because they recognise that actually there's skilled people in prison. They've just kind of got a bit of a wrong turn in life. But actually, some of them could be really good employees. So there, maybe there are some things that you can do. We think, actually, I don't want to be a youth worker, or I don't want to do that. But actually, there's maybe something you can do with your working life. Do you know what I mean? That actually could do like that. I don't know how we have time, but let's have another question.
We're fine, Tim. We've got about 10 minutes. Oh, so brilliant. If people keep putting their hands up, I'll get around as many as I can.
Brilliant. Let's go for another one.
Hi, I teach 5 to 16-year-olds who are not able to go to school for various reasons. And when I speak to people about my job, if I say I'm teaching a 6-year-old who's suffered horrendous trauma, his mental health means he can't go to school, everybody's very sympathetic towards that child. If I say I'm teaching a 15-year-old whose bail conditions mean they can't go to school, he carries a knife, for this, that and the other, the reaction's very different. Yeah. How can we change the narrative and make sure that that's sympathy... people understand that the 16-year-old is exactly the same child as the traumatised 6-year-old.
Well said. Brilliant. Really good. Brilliant question.
That's an amazing question. Can I chuck one back at you or not? After that person has that attitude towards the 16-year-old, what do you say back? Do you try and communicate? Okay, cool. Because that would be, that would be my answer. If people aren't proximate to a situation, if they don't know the details of the trauma that that person's been through, they're going to make judgments, they're going to write them off, they're going to think it's too late, they're going to think of them as an adult. But I always say that people that are in pain, it started with pain, and through that trauma, they've landed where they are. But I think as Christians, our perspective is to never, ever give up on anyone, regardless of their age, and to try and be a bit of a bridge from them to people that might have prejudgments about them. So I'd say conversation, building relationships, and almost being an ambassador for those young people and letting them know that it's never as simple as it is, or as it seems, rather.
The only thing I would add is, like, we need to find ways of help, of enabling people to tell stories, I think, like the stories of their lives. I mean, I know it's a different context, but we did a piece of work that was around bringing communities together to understand, bring some understanding about immigration. And actually, we had people who were very anti-immigrant hearing the stories of people who travelled to get here. And actually, they were deeply moved by hearing those stories. Once you make it kind of more personable, like, actually, what would I have done in that situation if I'd grown up in that context? Like, what my life might have looked like? Do you know what I mean? Like, I think you create a bit more empathy. And I think empathy is the thing that you need to change the story. If you don't empathize with others in a story, do you know what I mean? I think it's very hard to kind of get people like in a different space with that, which is why I think Jesus is such a master storyteller, because he helps people locate themselves in a story, do you know what I mean? And recognize themselves in it. And I think that's what can bring about a huge amount of like change. How we do that is a different question, but I think some storytelling that enables us to kind of get there, I think.
Great move for here now, Tim.
Hi, so I teach in the Highwick and Buckinghamshire area, which is seen as both a economically well-off area as well as having areas of need. I remember being in school, and I was in a state school where we were searched weekly for drugs, but the grammar schools, which also happened to be some of the higher areas for county lines, were not. How can we change the stereotype that non-grammar school areas are more protected from that state of vulnerability compared to non-grammar schools?
Yeah, that's a big question. I don't actually know the answer to it, but I know that the attitudes are everywhere. It's like in London, people in Canary Wharf, the big bankers that are buying drugs every day, they don't get thought about at all. But on the estates, they're getting searched every other day. And I think we live in an elitist society that isn't fair. The only answer I have is to continually look in the mirror and challenge our own thinking and how we view people. But from like a policy level, it's a difficult one.
Yeah, I think it is a real challenge, isn't it? I think, you know, I remember we were talking about county lines in North London, which is where the organisation that I used to run like had a particular piece of work going on. And we were talking about the police started talking about the issue is middle class and upper middle class cocaine users in Norfolk. Right. So until we tackle middle class cocaine users in Norfolk, because kids are literally getting on trains and running drugs into Norfolk. That's what's going on. So kids who are really disadvantaged, you can't see a different way out, are being manipulated and recruited like in those kind of the communities that we were working in. And they've been sent on trains to kind of feed the drug habit of middle class cocaine users. So if you know any middle class cocaine users, tell them to stop. Like. Greenbelters are people who want to challenge injustice, aren't we? I've been coming to Greenbelt for God knows how many years, and it's the thing I love about the place. Do you know what I mean? Is that? So let's speak up about this stuff and say, actually, what is causing this? And let's not buy into these stereotypes. It's just to do with, you know, single parents in disadvantaged communities who don't know how to parent their kids. Like, it's much more complicated than that. And actually, we're all complicit. And if we're all complicit, then actually we need to call that out. Like, we need to do something about that. Sorry, that wasn't a real answer to the grammar school question, but it's sort of on the same lines.
Thank you for this conversation. I think one of the things for me, which I'm slightly confused about, is some of the conversations about almost making people more middle class, introducing them to more high corporate careers, all the rest of it. The church has been quite criticised in the past for not including people and for making them more middle class, and I'd just be really interested in your reflections on that.
What a good question.
I don't know if I agree with the making them more middle class aspect. I think class is such a difficult thing to define. But the way I look at it is providing a young person with as many opportunities for them to reach their full potential as possible, so that they have the choice and the option regardless of background. And I think in settings where I've been with people from completely different backgrounds, I haven't felt like... You have like the imposter syndrome, but I haven't felt like I needed to change who I am or I need to become one of them. I feel like we learn from each other. And the way I think about that is just providing young people with as many opportunities as possible, regardless of background.
If I could have the kind of prime minister for a day thing, I say this to people all the time. Like, if I could have one job in government other than prime minister, I'd be education secretary. Because I think what happens is we've created there's a great TED talk called Do Skills Kill Creativity by a guy called Sir Ken Robinson. Like, it's brilliant. And what he talks about is, so it goes to your class thing, is in essence, we've created an education system post-industrial revolution, which in essence is an elongated university entrance exam. That's what he talks about. So he says what we do is we educate kids gradually from the waist up and then from the head up. So he talks about that in no education system in the world, modern education system in the world, do we teach dance, for example, every day to children. But we teach maths every day because that's an industrial, post-industrial revolution need. So I would say, so it's a big thought, but I think we need to overthrow the education system and the way that it works. Because what it, thank you. And it's because of what it values. Yeah. And the reason we're having these, you know, we have got people who are graduates coming back and working in shops, right? Because actually we've created this academic kind of grade inflation model where the system isn't working because it's not meeting the need that we have. And we live in a flexible, adaptable, fast-moving, like, economic environment. And so actually helping young people tap into their ingenuity, their creativity, their passions, that is what the world of work needs. And yet what we do is we make lots of kids feel stupid in the system because they are not on the track to that university entrance thing. And I think until we change that, we're going to keep making kids feel stupid. And if you're made to feel stupid, you'll go and do something else. Yeah. So we need to change that, I think.
And from like a class perspective, having a respect for people that aren't like you or don't have the same skill set. Because I can be, I don't know, in a place with someone that plays a double bass, for example, and they'll be regarded as like an incredible musician. But me as a rapper, sometimes frowned upon. And I always say, like, I think if Shakespeare was alive today, he'd be a rapper. Do you know what I mean? So we need to change the way that we view these things.
Shakespeare as a rapper, that's the thing you can take away with you for the day.
Tim, come back to the front. Because you've given such fabulous and full answers, we're nearly at time. And it's such a shame because I've been trying to get round as many questions as we can. Are you available as people finish to pick up? Then I would suggest as you move across there and people can come and find you, continue those conversations. I think the fullness of the conversation has encouraged us that this is something that we want to feed back to Greenbelt for another year to keep the conversation going. So we'll do that on your behalf. Isaac, Tim, thank you so much. Thank you for being an amazing audience, for being so patient with your questions. Do come and speak to Isaac and Tim. I can certainly recommend asset-based community development if you are involved in church leadership or church work. I did training with Tim 5 years ago, and I'm evangelical about it as well. So do continue those conversations.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.